This commences the regular meeting for the San Juan County Public Hospital District Number 1 Board of Commissioners. It is Wednesday, April 22nd, 2020. It's 5:30-ish. This is a regular meeting and we're holding it remotely under COVID-19 emergency rules. The public can call in at this time. The number is 509-824-1884. And please enter 259-984-829-pound. But if they're already here, they already know that. Let's see, the proclamation that allows us to have this meeting remotely is Proclamation 20-28, which issued March 24th, and it prohibits us from public agencies from conducting in-person meetings and requires all remote meetings to provide an option for public attendance via remote access. For the purpose of this of record keeping, we do need a verbal roll call. And Board Recording Secretary Nathan Butler will read each person's name and please state that you are here for the record.
Commissioner Clary.
Present.
Commissioner Lehman.
Present.
Commissioner Lindstrom.
Here.
Commissioner Lachine Sides is absent. Mm-hmm. Commissioner Loring.
Here.
Chief Kutzing.
Hi, present.
Just for public information, Chief Kutzing and Superintendent Hutchins are here as well. Thank you.
Okay, so we have the consent agenda for our past regular meeting, our special meeting, the warrant approval for the public hospital district and the EMS warrant approval. May I hear a motion to approve the consent agenda?
I make a motion to approve the consent agenda as written.
May I hear a second?
Second. This is Commissioner Loring.
Thank you. Okay, so we'll vote to approve, and I will just do that as a roll call like we did before. So, Everett?
Aye.
Trish?
Aye.
I vote yes to approve. And Kyle?
Yes.
Thank you. Now we open it up to audience participation. The 15-minute limit total, and the comments are maximum 3 minutes per person. Nathan, are you aware that anyone is on the call for public comment?
This is Nathan. I didn't get any notices that people wanted to make public comment. We have about 4 or 5 guests.
Okay, great, thank you. And so, at this time, no public comment? Okay. So, that then moves us to the operations report for the public hospital district, and I'll hand things over to our superintendent, Pam.
Thank you. Thank you. So, for March, the total receipts posted were $171,017.87. And all of that was March property tax revenues. The ending cash balance for March was $822,624.57. And it is still showing a high balance because the $511,294 of the subsidy payment of Peace Health hasn't come through to get taken off our balance yet. So that will come. Disbursements, we had a total of $13,846.72, and they were all for accounts payable. We only had one record request for March. It didn't result in us spending any additional money for that, and that brings our total to 2 for the year. In your packets that I sent out, there were revenue and expenditures amounts for just March, and then that showed you the total for the year. And then I also put a comparative fund balance that had 2018, 2019, and 2020. So you could see comparisons of the years. And did anybody have any questions about those? Nope. Okay. And my operations report was rather long this month, a lot longer than normal, but it was because it was reporting a lot on what our audit for 2019, what the exit interview showed, and it was a lot better than the audit before. We didn't have any findings. There were a couple of management letters on the things listed, one for EMS for theft-sensitive assets and one for continuing on our financial reporting when we talk to the CPA to make sure we understand and can help with the auditors when we do work with them. And then there was a couple of exit recommendations on the credit card controls. And it was a really pretty good audit. They always find some things to improve on, and if we didn't have anything to improve on, that wouldn't be good either. So did anybody have any questions about the audit, what the information showed?
What improvements did they have, did they suggest?
For when we're working with the CPA, for me to make sure that I go over everything that is done, and so that I know exactly what the CPA did, and I can repeat that back to the auditors when they come the next time, and also that I can be able to show it to the commissioners and have a checklist of what when the CPA works with us and has those year-end adjusting figures and working on the cash reconciliation and the audit report. So that was one. And for the EMS theft-sensitive assets, they wanted a further segregation of duties for like if something is added to the assets, one person does that. If it's taken off, a different person should do that. If it's being checked in, a different person, you know, just is a, so it is a good system of checks and balances of those inventory items. They did go over a new system. EMS was getting a new system for those kinds of things, and Katie English and Carl and Heather, they extensively went over that with them before they left, and they approved that system and thought if we implemented it just the way that they showed it to them, then when they check in with us in the fall, that everything should be fine on that. Let's see what the other... Credit cards, just to make sure that the people are signing their receipts and on that, and that if Carl has charges, that I would approve, look at his charges. If I have charges, then Nathan or him should look at them so that somebody else additional has eyes on on what, you know, checking those off.
Sure.
And that was about it for the... So they'll be back in the fall, October, first part of November, just to look at the 2019 audit report, which is being worked on now. And it's just the financial reporting of it, so it's not the big long audit like we just went through. It doesn't have the accountability portion. That will happen the next fall when they do 2019 and 2020. So that's about it.
Yeah, thank you for that. I'm glad we're getting better reports back from the auditor. It's just great.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Me too. So that basically was a lot of the operation report, other than everybody knows we started the COVID-19 stay at home and working from home and the EOC and all of those things that have come into our daily lives, and everybody's working on that ahead of a lot of other things these days. That's about it for the operations. Anybody have any questions? You can all read the 4-page report, and it is posted on the website.
Yes, it's great. Thank you, Pam. Does anybody have any questions?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. Then I guess Chief Kutzing, you're up.
Good evening, everyone. Hopefully everybody can hear me all right. Sounds good. Okay.
Yes.
So, obviously, you've had a chance to take. Hopefully, you've had a chance to take a look at just some of the highlights. We're at 79 runs for March, which brings our total for the year to 231 runs, which is basically it's about a 9% decrease that we're seeing. Our shoot time is acceptable. I'm 2 minutes and 52 seconds. We're always striving to get that down. Part of that is an artifact of within town right now. Our operations say that the ambulance can roll with a single EMT, but if you're going out of town, we're hoping to we want 2 EMTs on the rig, and so sometimes there is that delay. That's the biggest piece that we can be working toward, is to try to get those response times, or I'm sorry, the shoot time or the reflex times, another term that's used, get those down and get the ambulance out the door much, much quicker. Our overall response time, which is from time of page to actually making, to arriving on scene, was 8 minutes and 42 seconds for this reporting period. And again, we're using the benchmarks for suburban, and I've also included some of the urban area benchmarks in there. This is for an ambulance, not necessarily just aid. So the suburban benchmark is 20 minutes. The urban benchmark for an ambulance is 10 minutes. For aid, just getting resources on scene to the patient, the urban benchmark is 8 minutes, so it saves 2 minutes off of that urban response time. And within a suburban area for aid to be rendered, that's 15 minutes. And so I think what I'd like to do is to start looking at those benchmarks rather than the ambulance benchmarks as something that we're striving towards. Because we're consistently under the 20 minute over 80% of the time, which is kind of what we're looking to do. But I think we can do better. So we're looking.
Carl, can I interrupt you for 1 second? You cut out as you were introing that, and it's probably my internet, and I'm sorry. So you were saying that you're talking about response times of someone on scene rather than the ambulance on scene?
Right. There are two different benchmarks. There's what they call an aid benchmark, which is the 8 and 15 urban and the ambulance benchmark, which includes the transport portion of that, which then translates as 10 minutes and 20 minutes. So while we're consistently under that 20-minute benchmark, which is appropriate for our population size, we can do better. So I want to start looking at that 8-minute, 15-minute, rather than the 10-minute, 20-minute benchmark and see how we're starting to stack up with that. Because that's what I prefer to shoot for.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So that kind of gives the stats. Finances-wise, I provided you all with the Eden reports. The highlights are we're 25% into the year. Our revenue year to date is about 16% of what we've expected. So obviously revenue is down. A lot of that has to do with how taxes are being collected and the reduced number of runs. Conversely, for the expenditures, we're at 20% of budget projections, so we're less than the 25% of into the year, mm-hmm. but still our expenses are exceeding our income right now, or our revenue, I should say. So obviously we have to be very mindful of that and be watching for that. This is a situation with the COVID response where call, and this is true across the country, call volumes are down. ER visits are down. A lot of rural hospitals are having to furlough people and use service because people are hunkering in and they're staying home. There's there's lots of factors that go into it. So not doing as many things which might cause injury or accident, not being on the road as much which might cause injury or accident, and I think a fear of going into a hospital setting where all those germs are available are also having people think twice before calling or going into the ER or into the clinic itself. So we want to keep all those things in mind, given that we've been good at being fiscally responsible and not overspending. We still have 8 months of operating expenses ready with cash on hand and in our reserves. So we're okay for the time being, but we definitely need to keep our eyes open and be mindful of what's coming down the pipe in the future. Any questions about the finances?
Well, to that point, I had a question about staffing levels. You know, we got prepared for this, obviously, and you made sure you maybe upped your staffing or and things like that in preparation for this. And I'm wondering that now that we know that calls are down and we have a system in place, is it wise at this point to scale back a little bit and know that you have an emergency system that's ready to go in terms of staffing? Or does it stay in place? I'm not sure how that plays with us being in a state of emergency and FEMA reimbursements, but I just wondered.
Yes, I understand. Yeah, we've had a few challenges in that, you know, in trying to get the staffing up to speed. We started out pretty strong, and then we had some glitches in terms of we haven't quite had the consistency and on a regularly scheduled basis with filling that second seat. Keeping that in mind, we really didn't initiate this until the last week of March in this reporting period. So I think as we look forward and we take a look at what April has and we'll have a better picture of that and see how we need to adjust that staffing issue. We are, you know, working hand in hand with the fire district right now and trying to make sure that we've got adequate staffing across the board 24/7. So, I think, you know, it's not the time to relax right now. We want to stay system ready. We did receive one of our first reimbursements from the Washington CARES Act, which is promising. So because we got that into place with the FEMA and getting us registered with those reimbursement programs. So I think we want to hold a course for the foreseeable future until we know more about how the governor is going to deal with the dialing back or not dialing back of the stay at home, stay safe order that he's got there. And I think we might have lost Commissioner Lindstrom. So.
Oh.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Her picture.
I see that. She's gone.
She was gone. So we'll see if we can get her back. But hopefully that answered her question and the rest of you, you know, that was an adequate response. So I'll just kind of keep moving forward right now. I just did want to hit some of the highlights there. I did mention that we had been in contact with the paramedics union, and that we had put an MOU in place for them to take a look at. I haven't gotten any word back as far as, well, I did have a conversation with the union president, who's based out of Marysville right now, and saying that they were unwilling to sign that draft of the MOU at this time, but I have gotten no edits in terms of what portions they weren't happy with. So we'll have to kind of wait and see. The dialogue has kind of started. Again, what I was saying here was we have enacted an emergency declaration. Gives us the ability to be nimble and move quickly. I did. We haven't changed anything in terms of the medic's response or their working conditions or any portion of it. The MOU was a have it in place in case those changes needed to come down. But so we still have some time. No changes have been made in those terms at all. But I would like to have a memorandum of understanding that the idea behind that, reassuring the bargaining unit that we're not changing the collective bargaining agreement, and this is not setting any sort of precedent. It's just what we need to do to deal with this crisis and deal with this emergency. So that's one of the things that I wanted to make you aware of. As well as in terms of operations, we've been kind of hunkered down and trying to fine-tune our response to the COVID crisis and dealing with the regular 911 emergencies that come forward. We've also been working with other partners in the community. We helped them get their N95 masks fitted. That was the coroner's office. That was Eventide Health. Anybody who's been, you know, kind of forced to move into that N95 mask protection. We've been doing our best to get them set, fitted, knowing that they're wearing them correctly and have them ready to go with those. Just to kind of also another quick little highlight as far as our staff training, the Department of Health has kind of suspended any of the hands-on skills and deadlines because of this response to the COVID crisis, where they're not requiring, they've extended some of those deadlines for ongoing training. But we have done our regular run reviews in a remote meeting, much like this one, and that we did our first one last month, and it went very well. There was good participation. We're going to try it again this coming Tuesday, which is our regularly scheduled training, and we'll be dealing with Dr. Corsa. We think we've got a way to kind of do some demonstration things that everybody will be able to see through the Teams application, and we had good dialogue last time around. So we're going to keep with that. I do have some statistics that Director Volk got for me for the Community Paramedicine Project. Just some quick hard numbers for you guys. Since we started tracking patients involved with community paramedicine, 114 total since we started tracking. 12 of them have deceased. 17 have left the area, 19 cases are active, and that leaves about 66 cases that are either inactive or closed. Again, community paramedicine tends to be a bit of a moving target. Lainey was explaining to me that oftentimes we're dealing with a patient. We see them pretty regularly. They seem to be doing better. She'll set the case to inactive, and there might be something 2 months down the line where they need a little bit of extra support, so we'll reopen the case and get started with them again. But those are the current numbers as they stand right now. Other than that, just to kind of update you a little bit with the COVID-19 situation, they had been planning for this surge capacity. And surge capacity, if you don't recall, was when the hospital reaches its capacity, when mainland hospitals and facilities reached their capacity. We were putting plans in place to have facilities where patients could go. That plan has since been shelved. They have it ready. It's set. It's got a nice little bow on it and ready to go if it's deemed necessary to open that up. So that's good. The plans are in place. They've decided that they don't have to implement them at this time. The other thing that's kind of new is coming up with some facilities that can serve as isolation facilities, or I'm sorry, isolation and quarantine facilities. So, for example, if a EMS, any fire EMS responder has contact with a COVID positive patient and they have family at home who might be susceptible, they can quarantine themselves in a separate facility. They don't have to bring that home to their families. So those facilities are being identified on San Juan, Orcas, and Lopez Islands, and they're just about done. So we haven't had to pull that trigger yet. They're not completely in place and ready to go, but if push to shove, we could push the envelope a little bit. But that's really all that's happening right now. The county EOC had a operational period that there were two operation periods within the week. They've scaled it back to just one operational period within the week because a lot of the planning and the pieces are in place and we're kind of status quo right now. So that's kind of the update with the COVID situation. And that's really all I have in my report. And I am happy to entertain any questions.
I got booted and I'm back, but I'll just follow up with you on that question I had earlier with you at another time, Carl. Sorry.
All right, fair enough.
Okay, go ahead, Trish.
I just have, it's just curiosity. What facilities or places are available for San Juan Island for quarantine or isolation needs?
I think they were in negotiations with one of the hotels. So that's what they have been looking for is, you know, obviously with their, the number of people coming to the island to visit, they don't have a whole lot of, they have a lot of vacancy. So the plan was to use those facilities there. And I can't recall which one is the one here on the
side. Yeah, that's okay. I was just curious. Yeah, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Has the virus affected the community paramedicine in any way? Has it decreased the load or increased the load? Or
the load is, thank you, that's a really good question. And the load is stayed pretty much the same, but Lainey has kind of modified her technique, a lot more phone-in kinds of things than face-to-face and some doorway kinds of visits when those are deemed necessary. So not so much going and visiting those patients because they are generally they are part of that vulnerable population. So I don't think in terms of total contact has changed very much. It's the way the contact is being done. So they've scaled back that way, masks in place, talking from the porch, talking from the doorway, or on the phone.
Is there any sense for how long this is going to go on? In other words, I've heard a lot of reports how things like the flu, a lot of the respiratory illnesses have disappeared because the stay at home, the hand washing, the masks, are the common ways that those illnesses used to just run through the population. And so this is obviously having a real effect, and it's having an effect on the transmission of the virus. And so we're really, really slowing down the movement of the virus. So but how long can we keep it up?
Yeah, good question. Corona crazy. The State Department of Health has a really good website. They're tracking number of reported cases. They just added a section with the epidemiological curve. And it does show that, we're, as far as the number of newly reported cases in Washington, that that's down. But what's been typical is kind of a downturn off the top of that bell curve, and then a couple of bumps that that show little increases. Not generally, they haven't been as high as the initial curve top in terms of new cases being reported, but we're still pretty early on. That, and I think that's why the governor in his speech the other day was hesitant to put any hard and firm data on it. Of course, you know, the public health officers would say just shut it all down until it's done. But we have economic aspects. We're seeing all sorts of other ramifications, social ramifications that happen because of the stay-at-home order. And you're exactly right. How long can are people willing to tolerate staying home, staying away from work, not being able to gather with other people before they just say, "Yeah, I'm not playing anymore." So I don't envy the governor his position and having to navigate that, those restrictions and those orders that he's got out there.
Yeah, so you don't really have any sense for how long you're going to have to keep operating this way.
What we're doing is we're kind of basing our cues off of the governor. And how they're doing, what they're doing at the state level. So if the governor is saying it's status quo for, you know, through May 4th, that's where we're planning on keeping this response model in place. If he scales it back, we may do the same, depending on how far he scales it back. If he lifts the order, then we'll take an analysis and take a look and see. But generally, our plan of our operational period has been matching what matches what the governor's proclamations are doing.
Okay, thank you.
That's it for me.
Okay, do we have anything else for Chief Kutzing at this time? No? Okay, so we'll move on to our committee reports. I'm not sure if there's much here that I can think of. I don't think there's any off-island. Correct me if I'm wrong. The CCC did not meet. The EMS and Trauma Care Council, Gail's not with us tonight. Is there anything to report there, Carl?
No, it was, I think we talked about it in the special meeting. I would have from that one. Oh, and I did fail to mention, I provided just this morning kind of our pandemic emergency leave kind of policy that's in place. And per our counsel, Rich Davis, who represents the hospital district, he was looking at it and said, really, the only signature we need is mine. So I signed off on that. And it's basically, it works in conjunction with the pandemic, what's the state one? I'm sorry, it's the federal proclamation that is the, hang on, I'll find it here. Yes, it goes with the Families First Coronavirus Response Act that was enacted federally. So it works hand in hand with that. It's basically trying to keep status quo, keep the sick leave in place, not have to have people burn through their sick leave if they have to be isolated or quarantined or end up being diagnosed with COVID-19. So that then, you know, it can be rescinded at any time. So once the crisis is over, that's done. And probably the other thing that you guys as commissioners need to do is just make sure that you've had a chance to say, yes, that declaration of emergency is still in place and we want to keep that going. I think the way that the policy was written is that with every one of your regular meetings that you take some time to say, yeah, are we still in the same situation? Do we keep everything in place or do we say, no, it's time to finish that? But my recommendation is we're still dealing with it. The county health officers figure that there's going to be another spike. They're hopefully not as big as the first one, but it's not, we're not ready to rescind anything just at this point in time.
Okay. I read through that draft and I see that we had the pandemic leave policy on under new business, which is fine. But I didn't really see anything that changed anything for the employees other than it would just preserve their time off and their sick leave in case they got sick. And that's really it. So it's very protective.
Yes, that's exactly the plan behind it. And I apologize for jumping the gun. I don't have the agenda.
That's okay.
Oh, there's something else I need to talk about.
No, yeah, that seems fine. And it seems that the state of emergency would just be dictated by whatever the governor does.
I would tend to agree.
More or less. And that's all connected to emergency funding. So we want to stay in this place as the governor says that we should. Yeah, okay. Anything on the CID?
Sorry, I muted my microphone. no, nothing. Haven't heard anything from the attorney at this point in time.
No response.
It's probably about time to kind of see what's going on. Again, I think it's just the state attorney general has probably got other things on his mind right now.
Yeah, right. Okay, right. The finance committee, any reports there? Everett and I have been stewing about money, actually, the past week, worrying about revenue and such, and it's interesting to note that calls are down 9%, and therefore revenue and property tax revenue will be down. Yeah. Everett, anything to add there?
You know, I just have this incredible fear that something is looming over us that's, I think as Trish knows, my wife works for Skagit Valley Hospital, and they just announced a 15% rollback because of, they've had a major reduction in income because hospitals get a big chunk of their income from elective surgeries. And elective surgeries are out the window. And so as a result of a 15% reduction in their force, they have reduced 300 full-time equivalents. 300 full-time equivalents. So I would imagine that Peace Health is going to be going through the same thing. And there's going to be trickle down. Now, we may not have a lot of elective surgeries at our local hospital, but our local hospital has got to be some portion of that percentage. Everybody's going to be going through that.
Yeah.
So that's very real. I follow airplane business a lot. You know how many flights go in and out of San Francisco every week? San Francisco International? Mm-hmm. About 5,700. You know how many are going out of there a week now? 48.
Oh my God.
48 flights.
Wow. That's like less than 1%.
48.
Wow.
Seattle is gone from about 2,700 to 35 flights a week. So it's the airline industry is collapsing. It's happening all over the world. It's not just in the United States. This kind of, and as I was telling you, Annalisa, about the International Monetary Fund, their economic forecast for 2020 was minus 3.1%. And the economic forecast or the economic growth rate in 2009 was minus 0.1%. This year is going to be 30 times worse than the recession of 2008. So I really, really think that what is coming down the pike is going to be really, really something. So when I say I'm worried about the finances, I don't think that we're going to anticipate what it's going to be. Just like we just never anticipated this virus. Somehow We thought it was going to be an earthquake or a volcano or something like that.
Yeah.
Certainly not a virus, but here it is. Mm-hmm. And I think that all of the things that we worried about in terms of finances, in terms of, you know, how we were going to fund long-term care, how we were going to blend EMS and fire, how we were going to, all the things that we were worrying about funding, that's nothing compared to what's coming. And so I am just scared to death of that, mostly because I don't know what it's going to be, but I think it's going to be real and it's going to be of monumental proportions. So I feel like we shouldn't spend a nickel more than we have to, and that we should not incur any more in anything. It just feels like this is a really, really important time to be smart about our nickels and our dimes.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's a financial committee issue other than just me talking about my financial fears. We did pay our property taxes for the whole year. we did our part. But other than that, you know, I have to thank Pam and Chief Kutzing and all the people that do the financial ends of things. I'm so relieved that the auditor's report, I felt, was actually really good, because I felt like they were just saying, you know, these are areas you can work on. It was not, I didn't feel like they were admonishing us at all. They were just like, these are things that need to be done. I didn't feel like it was in the least bit really negative. It was helpful, not negative, not punishing in any way. They weren't trying to admonish us. They were trying to help us and not worried about us. And so if they can keep doing the job that they've been doing, I say hooray and thank you so much. That could have been an awful experience and it was not. So thank you. So that's all I have to say. Thanks.
Thanks. I just wanted to chime in, even though I'm not on the financial committee, just on the financial note and my concerns. And you did mention this one item, which was integration. And I think that's something that we do need to be looking at very closely because of the change in the financial status given the pandemic. And I think we need, as you said, we can't be spending an extra nickel. So I think that's something we need to start looking at very, very closely to see if, what that impact could be and whether or not it's appropriate, you know, to move forward with integration because of the financial status.
If I may, just my two cents is that's something that as we've been working toward this, it's something to keep in mind. The fire district has a permanent levy, and they have some real stability. We go out every 6 years, so and then that's kind of very dependent on you know what the financial flavor is, what the real estate market is. So mm-hmm. so actually, in terms of finances, moving forward with the integration is probably going to create more stability for 911 responses. And also, you know, as we know, just on a very, very cursory level, the redundancies that we have in maintaining two different organizations that basically have the same mission, something to keep in the back of your mind as well.
Sure. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Carl.
Okay, where are we? We touched on... I don't know. Is there anything else to report on all of these things? I guess integration steering committee, we sort of jumped ahead to that more or less. I think to that note and jumping from financials to integration, I think, Carl, maybe it would be wise for you and me and Everett as our alternate to set up a meeting just to kind of check in about how things are going there. You know, we had talked about looking at the financial picture You know, I'm still really interested in connecting with staff at EMS about this process. You know, I know that it seems like under the umbrella of this emergency operations are sort of moving forward as a joint agency, is at least my understanding. I'm sorry, I cut out for a few minutes earlier in the meeting, but I understand fire is responding to EMS calls with fire rig now. Is that correct?
That is correct. You know, and that goes, that was part of the whole process of integrating, was that we wanted to make sure that the licensing aspects were in place, so that once that happened, and transfer the license, that if we turned off the public hospital district EMS license, that we would turn on the fire district 3 EMS license, and there would be, it would be seamless. So by them having that BLS aid license in place, we're using that to our advantage, in that through the COVID response, we've got an engine staffed. It's a BLS engine with firefighter EMTs on every rotation, as well as us running with the ambulance and doing that in kind of a seamless way. And it almost is kind of like a trial balloon for us to see how a fully integrated system would be working. And it's been working very, very well. And I'm happy for us to sit down and talk and keep you apprised of what we're doing. In fact, Assistant Chief Monin and I have put together a representative group to start looking at planning of what staffing and deployment would look like in a fully integrated system. Of course, this is all being done with the you know, specter of COVID-19 hanging over us, but we feel like it's important to keep moving forward and striving that way. Happy to fill you in, and if you want me to include Chief Collins in that discussion, I can reach out to him as well, and happy to answer your questions. Yeah, and then, yeah, let's get something scheduled, and I can bring you up to speed about where we are.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I think that in a previous meeting we had talked about putting integration processes on hold during the state of emergency. It sounds like, you know, obviously you're collaborating under the umbrella of the emergency. So I just had a question about that. I was curious about PPE use. Like, is everyone gearing up like that for a response? I mean, you're having a larger response now than you normally do. I mean, I'm just saying this because I know, because I drove home the other night after baking bread, and there was like a fire truck, and everybody was there. I passed a thing where everybody was out. So I'm wondering, like, is it wise right now to send out a bigger response crew on a call when potentially more people can be exposed to COVID-19 and potentially they're using more PPE just because they're responding?
Yeah.
Just curious. So, I'm not sure what your process
is. Yeah, just to kind of let you know. So what's happening is we're sending out both rigs so that whoever's can get there first can get there first. We're limiting the number of folks that are actually making patient contact. So, for example, if you see both the engine and the ambulance show up, mm-hmm. if the ambulance is there first making that first patient contact, that crew has the appropriate PPE on. The engine crew would hang back, and they would not necessarily don PPE or even be have contact with the patient, but they're there as hands-on, if it's a lift and carry kind of situation, if we have a really severe ALS kind of patient, we've got the resources there without having to necessarily put that or to broadcast that out to the general volunteer staff. So it's, while it might look like there's more people on scene, we're being very mindful about who's donning PPE, who's making patient contact. But the thing is, we're using the same set of people. So instead of having 60-some responders, we're down to about 15 or 20 people who rotate through those responses. So we're actually limiting the number of people, number of responders who are making contact with the patients. That's for the community safety as well as mm-hmm. for keeping the rest of our volunteer responders safe.
How are the volunteer EMTs responding to that? Just in that they're kind of being told that fire's filling in for you right now. Is that being taken okay? I mean, that's sort of tough in a way when.
I understand, but part of that is that the people who are responding on the engine are also EMTs.
I know so many people are.
Right, yep. And so some of that is kind of that history, that baggage. Behind there saying, well, that was a fire engine, but no, it's the same people that you just saw training on that engine. So I think we're all right that way. But overall, whether it's on the fire, you know, the firefighter only, the EMT only, or the cross-trained personnel, they're all like itching. It's like, oh man, you know, that's why you sign up for this job. You want to help, you want to be, you know, part of that response. Okay. And we're asking a lot of them. We're asking, it's a tough thing that we're asking them to do, but I think they understand, and we'll be mindful of the operation and how we're exposing people. It's been very helpful to have those hands there ready to go in case you need them, and it's real easy to say, hey, we got this, engine 311, head back to quarters, we're good.
So I guess this is a fire department question, but if they're rolling their engine, is that... Like, I mean, that's an expense to them. Is that being covered under the emergency provisions, or is that just an added? I mean, I can ask Chief Collins that. That's just interesting.
Yeah. Just so you know that, we've got the pieces in place. We're tracking our special, you know, if any of these changes that we're doing are in response to the COVID virus and the declarations. We're tracking that separately. We've got pieces in place for asking, you know, for those reimbursements from the Fed and from the state.
Okay. Well, anyway, you and Everett and I will set up a time to do this again in front of computers, I'm assuming. Anything else in all of this? Kyle, do you have anything to add?
No, I don't have any questions. I think Commissioner Clary asked one or two earlier that I might have asked. Thank you for that.
Okay. And we spoke about pandemic leave policies, and it seems as though, I guess I'm moving on to new business. Carl has signed off on that, so do we need to approve that, Nathan?
My understanding was that staff could draft policies and procedures, but the board needed to approve them. But it sounds like maybe Carl got different information, and I would defer to Carl on that.
Yeah, the information I got from Rich Davis, the attorney, was that at this particular one, being that it's in response to the emergency declaration, as long as it had my signature on it, that was all that was necessary, and that I was my role is to keep you apprised of what those unusual things are, and that we don't necessarily need the commissioners to ratify or approve it at this time. But
So we can pass on that then. It looks like. All right, thank you. And if there's anything else, we'll move on to audience participation.
You know, actually, I did have a question or two about those policies, if I might.
Sure.
Chair Lindstrom. One of the provisions that I noticed, and it was in each one but in a different place, I think I'm looking at the public hospital district version of it now, and it was in paragraph 2D. And it mentioned that any person who is not eligible for telecommuting and is a member of a high-risk group or has a family member that is a member of a high-risk group is not eligible for pandemic leave, but may choose to self-isolate and use their accumulated sick or vacation leave. And I think I just wasn't clear. I thought those were the kind of people who we wanted actually to be eligible for the pandemic leave. You know, staff members who aren't eligible for working remotely or in a high risk group or have a family member in a high risk group. And so basically are forced to stay home for some reason. Is there a reason why they're not the kind of people that we'd want the pandemic leave to cover?
Well, again, we do have a similar provision with the EMS one, and I believe that it we've got a fine line to deal with that. If they can't telecommute and they're it's basically it's for the people responding as opposed to the average worker. It's a provision that's in there right now that basically anybody who's on staff, full-time staff right now, we do have those provisions in place for for working remotely. It's more designed that kind of proviso is there for the responders, the people who, can't do their job, other than the contract folks, and I think I'm getting a little sideways on this. I'm trying to word this right way for you and why that provision was in there. And I remember Rich Davis talking about that. And I think I'm going to defer right now, Commissioner Loring, and just I want to go back and take a look at my notes so I'm not misspeaking over this, and that I can get back to you offline and make sure that I get your question answered.
Okay. Yeah, that would be great. And you're right. You have the same provision. Yours is a paragraph later, right? 2E instead of 2D. So I'd love to hear that, because when I read this, it encourages sick people to go to work. And I felt like that was the exact opposite of what we're trying to do, because they're not eligible actually for pandemic leave. Basically, they have to go in or use their own leave. And so anyway, I would definitely encourage leave. Any way we can grant leave to basically anybody who might need it and might otherwise choose to work in a place where they might infect others or take on a risk themselves.
Right. And I'll take a look. I'll contact Rich Davis as well to kind of go over that again. Again, I followed his lead on this particular one.
Sure.
And I'll verify that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks. And then I did have one other point, and this may be one that nobody is going to be that worried about, but it never really says what closure pay is. It talks about closure pay, and I think that's in that Article 3, right, where it talks about such employees will be provided closure pay in accordance with the provisions in this policy. That's Article 3, Paragraph A. But it never defines closure pay. So as long as people are comfortable with what that is, and I mean staff, and they feel like they will be compensated if needed with that closure pay, that's great. I just thought it was a little bit odd.
Yeah, I'll verify that as well. And I know it's not defined anywhere. My take on it was what the normal wage would be if we were forced to say, sorry, we have no other option, we just have to shut it down. But I'll get clarification on both of those points.
Thanks, Chief Kutzing. And that was my assumption reading it through, too.
But this H says the combination of an employee's regular pay and closure pay shall be equal to the employee's normal compensation.
Right, there's a word salad right there. What's the difference between regular pay and normal compensation? I thought those were the same, personally.
Okay, yeah.
My legalese isn't up to snuff yet, Commissioner. So I'll be working on that, and I'll get some more definitive answer for you.
Thank you. That's all. That's all I had. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Kyle. Anybody else? Nathan, do we have audience participation?
I've not received any notification that anybody would like to speak.
Okay. In that case, we can move on to any commissioner comments.
Actually, I do have one follow-up. This is Commissioner Loring, and I just want to thank you, the superintendent and chief, for putting together these leave policies. By the way, these are pretty critical components, and so thank you for getting those in place.
Well, shortest meeting ever. Congratulations, everyone.
It only took a virus.
I know, right? Thank you all to our PhD staff for the hard work that you're taking on right now. I know that, that it's a lot of extra that you're having to handle at this time. And, you know, with the EOC and creating new systems and protocols and policies. And anyway, I appreciate all of you, and your community does too. So at that, I think I would adjourn this meeting.
And I second that, but I second what you just said. Thank you, Pam and Nathan, for all your hard work. And Carl, you guys are awesome. And it does not go unnoticed and is very appreciated.
Thank you, fellow commissioners.
Thank you.
Yes, and thank you all. Stay safe.
Yes.
To everybody, stay healthy.
Yeah. Have a real life meeting one of these days.
Yeah.
Or a picnic or something.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye, everybody. Bye.